this room. Francis Collins received his bachelor's degree from the University of Virginia, a PhD in physical chemistry from Yale University, and an MD from the University of North Carolina. He returned to Yale, where he did a fellowship in human genetics, then joined the faculty of the University of Michigan. Among his notable research achievements are discoveries of the genes responsible for cystic fibrosis, neurofibromatosis, Huntington disease, and Hutchison-Gilford progeria syndrome. In 1993, he was wooed to the NIH to become the director of the National Human Genome Project, championing public access to the genetic code of human life and valiantly laboring for fairness and justice on behalf of persons with genetic conditions. He is a member of the Institute of Medicine and the National Academy of Sciences. Last fall, the American Society of Human Genetics honored him for his lifetime contributions to human genetics research. Tonight, we have welcomed him as a fellow in the American Scientific Affiliation. All this is remarkable, yet overshadowed in the light of his unabashedly public identification of himself as a devout Christian. As such, he is an enigma to many scientists. I know of no other scientist who speaks so openly and eloquently of the worshipful harmony between science and Christian faith as Francis Collins. This week marks the publication of his book titled, The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. I cannot recall a book receiving such pre-publication press as this one, which includes a three-page article in Time magazine titled, Reconciling God and Science. And appearances on national broadcast media have followed regularly. Copies of his book are available for discounted sale in the ASA bookstore, and after his presentation, he will be signing copies of his book. This evening, he is speaking to us on The Language of God, A Believer Looks at the Human Genome. Please join me in a warm welcome for Francis Collins.
Thanks, Bud, for a really wonderfully warm introduction. I've been looking forward to this evening for some time since it was possible to work this all out, and I'm really interested, and when we get to the questions, to have some discussion with all of you. And I'm even wondering if maybe those cards could be passed out a little earlier so people could be writing down things and not have sort of a crunch time at the last minute. So if that's possible, we might think about doing that so people have them in front of them as the questions come up. But I want to thank you for just wonderful leadership of this meeting. And also, since I am from somebody who lives inside the Beltway, it would not be proper for me to stand up here to address you without recognizing that we have a member of Congress with us this evening, Congressman Vernon Ehlers from Michigan. Very nice to see you, Congressman. Congressman is both a member of the advisory council to ASA and a physicist, and so it's wonderful to have him here, and I know he's going to be speaking later in the meeting. I thought I'd say a word about my own faith pathway because maybe it's relevant to what I'm going to tell you as far as this presentation on the human genome. I did not grow up in a home where faith was practiced. I did not go to a Christian college. By the time I was a PhD student in physical chemistry at Yale, I was an atheist. I decided that the only thing that really mattered were mathematics and physics. I loved those second-order differential equations that many of my friends found inscrutable. But along the way, I had this sense that maybe I had not jumped into the right pathway as far as my professional life, and I had a bit of a crisis about what to do next and ended up changing course completely and going to medical school. And in medical school, in that third year where you find yourself out there in the hospital wards and clinics interacting with patients who have terrible diseases that they did, for the most part, nothing to bring on themselves. And as I was in North Carolina listening to these patients recount their stories and finding how many of them really were leaning on their faith as a source of strength at a time where everything else seemed to be crumbling around them, I got rather curious about that. And one afternoon, a wonderful woman who was a patient of mine who had really terribly advanced coronary artery disease, for which we really had not much we could offer, After sharing her faith with me, she turned and looked me in the eye and said, "So, what do you believe?" And I hadn't really been asked that question before. And I stammered and stuttered and said, "Well, I don't think I believe any of what you've just said." But it felt very thin, that answer. And it bothered me because it seemed to me that I was becoming aware that I'd made a decision about faith that a scientist shouldn't make. That is, I decided to be an atheist without considering the evidence. It was convenient being an atheist, not being answerable to anybody, surrounded by lots of temptations and not having to worry too much about the consequences. But, you know, if there was an important question for any of us to ask, the most important question, it seemed to be, is there a God and does he care about me? And I hadn't really considered what the answer to that question might be based on evidence. So, convinced at that point that atheism was the right answer, but that I'd better darn well strengthen my arguments so I didn't get put in an embarrassing position again, I went about trying to learn something about the face of the world and got very confused because I really couldn't understand much of what I was reading in the Cliff Notes versions of Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, and so on. It didn't occur to me to read the original text, of course. That would have been a little too time-consuming. And so I walked down the street one day in my little town of Carrboro, North Carolina, and I knocked on the door of the office of a Methodist minister who lived on the street, and I explained to him my desire to understand more about this so that I could refute it. And he smiled and said, "Well, you know, I think there's a book that might help you because it's written by somebody who was on the same pathway that you seem to be on, and he was also a bit of an intellectual, so why don't you take this home and read it?" And he took down a little book from his shelf, and I took it home and opened it up. And by now you figured out this was C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity. And in that very first chapter, Right and Wrong, as a clue to the meaning of the universe, all of my arguments about the irrationality of faith lay in ruins. And I realized that my own conclusions had basically been those of a schoolboy, not really those of somebody who'd given the matter any serious consideration. That was very unsettling. I spent the next 2 years really trying to run away from that conclusion. Over the course of time, I did become convinced that just based on pure logic, it was more reasonable to believe in God than not to. But I also became very aware that you don't get all the way to faith on pure logic. You have to make that decision. And after many considerations about what kind of faith might appeal to me, the person of Jesus Christ loomed ever larger as I realized that this really was a person unlike any other. This was not just a man who claimed to know God, this was a man who claimed to be God. And this very much seemed to be God in search of me, just not me in search of God. And talking to many other Christians in my environment, including some scientists, some physicians, who I'm really glad that God put in my path, I ultimately felt this was just an irresistible conclusion. The historical evidence for Jesus Christ was very overwhelming to me, and the desire to give my life to him finally culminated on a beautiful afternoon hiking in the Cascade Mountains in the shadow of really beautiful natural scenery when I could no longer resist. And I fell on my knees and gave my life to Christ at age 27. But I was a geneticist. I was pretty excited about being a new Christian, so I told a lot of people around me, and about half of them said, "Well, get ready, your brain's going to explode soon because you have just brought into your worldview a spiritual perspective that is going to absolutely not go along with your scientific profession. So it's very nice that you've made this decision. It probably won't last." Well, it has lasted, I'm glad to say, almost 30 years. And gotten better and stronger as I've grown in my faith and grown as a scientist. And I'm here to tell you that I find absolutely not a shred of conflict between what I know as a scientist and what I believe about Christ as a believer. And that surprises a lot of people in the public. And I think that is unfortunate because the public often only hears about the conflict, about the idea that there are just absolutely irreconcilable differences between believers and scientists. And so in a certain way, I've been trying to write this book for 25 years, and finally I took a little bit of time, probably less than I should have, to write down some of these thoughts. What I want to do tonight is to walk you through, particularly initially from the perspective of science, what we've learned about the genome, and then bring that into a discussion about what that tells us about our Creator. Some of this may be uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for me. But I think we as scientists who are believers are all very much in the mode of believing that God gave us the opportunity to investigate His world. He gave us an intellect. He gave us the kinds of abilities to be able to design tools and technologies to explore the world around us. And as we do so, we're worshiping Him. And He, I think, is pleased by that action on our part. And the idea that somehow He would be threatened by our puny minds trying to understand how creation works just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And if in the process of discovering aspects of His creation, we encounter things that do not absolutely fit with our preconceived notions, then we have to struggle with that, and we should do so with all great intensity. But I don't think we have to worry that somehow truth is going to end up being in conflict with truth. God's truth is truth, whether it's spiritual truth or scientific truth. That's what I believe, and that's what I want to try to put forward here this evening, particularly as it comes to the study of DNA, because I think that does shed very important light on a particularly contentious area between science and faith, which is how we all got to be here anyway. Well, with that introduction, which was probably longer than it should be, let me start into this description of what we've learned about the genome. And of course, you've been reading about those things in places like this Time magazine. Interestingly, when they talk about DNA, they often use the motif of Adam and Eve. Or maybe they're just trying to use the motif of naked people because they know that sells magazines. Of course, DNA is an instruction book. I think if you had to pick a metaphor for this incredible information molecule, that's a pretty good metaphor. It's certainly the one that I find most useful in talking to non-scientists. We each have that instruction book inside each cell of our body. It's this incredible 3.1 billion letters in length, and every time a cell divides, you have to copy the whole thing. And as it passes from parent to child, most of the time it goes right, and once in a while something gets misspelled. And of course, the instruction book is made up of this wonderful double helix, the DNA molecule, which carries its information capacity in the order of the various letters or bases, which are always paired so that A pairs with T and G pairs with C, a marvelous way then of protecting against damage, because if one strand gets damaged, you can quickly fix it by using the information on the other strand. And of course, as pointed out by Watson and Crick, this provides a wonderful means of copying. And the genome of an organism is all of those base pairs, and organisms have genomes of different size that don't necessarily correlate with their biological complexity. Again, ours is 3.1 billion of these letters. And it is an amazing thing to contemplate that we now know that information. We have known it now for about 3 years. All of the letters of our own human instruction book have been sitting on the internet in a place where everybody who has a good idea can be working on it, and they are furiously. There are now tens of thousands of hits a day on the database where this information is stored, and many other browsers also display it. And graduate students working in the field of biology now cannot imagine how anybody ever did science without having this information. It's just sort of course, it was always there, wasn't it? Well, it wasn't, but it is now. And I think one of the things that I feel most good about in terms of the way this turned out was the dedication of the thousands of scientists in six countries that agreed to work together on this project and to put all that information on the internet every 24 hours without claiming any patents on it, and making sure that anybody who had a good idea had unfettered access to the information. And that really has become the ethic now of the genome field, not just for the sequence, but for lots of other data sets that we're generating. This is an open access model. The Human Genome Project got underway in 1990. It was rather controversial at first. A lot of people thought that this couldn't be done, or that it would cost more money than was actually being projected, or that it would be so boring that nobody who was a good scientist would want to work on it. I'm glad that part didn't turn out to be true. At least I don't think it did, because I got the chance to work with some of the best and brightest scientists of the generation who really got totally carried away with the vision of what this project was all about. This was historic. We only had to do this once in all of human history, and they could be part of that, and they were, and they did a fabulous job. The early parts of the project were devoted to trying to build technologies that were capable of handling a genome the size of ours, also building maps of it at lower resolution, and working on model organisms that had simpler genomes so that we could begin to learn how to do this. And that went pretty well, although there was lots of white knuckles at various points because we really were kind of making this up as we went along, and we had made a promise to get this done in 15 years without any assurances that that was going to be possible at the time. But by the second half of the project, things really got rolling. We were able to scale up the effort based on that experience and new technologies, and by 1999, we were sequencing 1,000 base pairs a second, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And so by 2000, there was a draft sequence in hand. By February of 2001, that was published. And by April of 2003, the finished human genome was then available on the web with an accuracy of no more errors than one out of every 100,000 base pairs, a truly very high standard for the sequence. What do we learn from this? Well, I could go on much longer than we have time to go through all of the interesting twists and turns that came out of having this instruction book in front of us. I'll just mention a very short list. One that surprised a lot of people is just how few genes we have. We've been talking about the gene count for human beings for quite a while as being about 100,000. It's a very back-of-the-envelope estimate, but nobody thought it would be that wrong. And now that the dust has settled and we have the sequence, there's still a little bit of tweaking around the edges here because computers are not ideally suited to find a gene and be sure it's a gene. But the total number of human genes is only about 20,000. Is a remarkably small number when you consider the complexity of our organism. So clearly that each of these genes must be doing a lot of things. This is daunting, and some people, even in the religious community, got a little upset about this because it turns out that 20,000 is also the gene count for a roundworm, and it's not a whole lot more than the gene count for a fruit fly. And there are some organisms like rice, for instance, that have more genes than we do, and so at dinner tonight, there were things on your plate that had more genes than you do. But you know what? That's okay. Obviously, our complexity must have something more to do with other things than just counting up the number of genes. It obviously works, and none of those other organisms have sequenced their own genome. Okay. Right? Okay. Another thing we learned by studying not just a single individual, because the public project was sequencing DNA from multiple individuals, all of whom are anonymous donors. We don't know who they are, and they don't know who they are because we collected DNA from a much larger group than we actually used, and we did that on purpose, is that we're all an awful lot alike. Your DNA and mine are 99.9% the same. Regardless of which of you I picked, that would be true. So we really are part of a family, in a sense that few other species could claim. So if you look at all these kids here with all of their different modes of dress and different skin color and hair texture, you might conclude that these are all very different folks. Well, they're 99.9% the same. Yeah? Now, we also now have the opportunity, because we have this sequence of the genome, to really begin to focus on that 0.1% of difference. And this is a huge opportunity for understanding what the hereditary factors are for common diseases. Because some of those differences are maybe ones you wish you didn't have that are placing you at risk for something. And even here in the ASA, I have to tell you a bad bit of news, and that is there are no perfect specimens. We all have flaws. This is the genetic equivalent of original sin. We are all fallen creatures at the DNA level. And we're all walking around with dozens of these glitches which place us at risk for something. Most of them you won't find out about because you don't have the environmental trigger that sets them off or the collection of glitches that is sufficient to get you over a threshold. But we are, in the next short period of time, going to discover many of these for common diseases. And that's going to be very exciting because of its possibility of providing information about disease. This is the group that's been working on that very intensely, trying to understand that 0.1%. This is another big organized project like the Genome Project, involving six countries, thousands of scientists. This one only took 3 years. It's actually done now, called the HapMap Project. Again, I had the privilege of being the project manager for this enterprise and watching this take shape over a remarkably short period of time. And we now have an incredibly detailed catalog of the variation in the human genome that we never thought we would get until much beyond this time. And it's also now sitting on the internet to be able to use so that people will, in the next a little while, find the major genetic factors for all of the diseases you see listed here and many others, anything that has a hereditary contribution. We finally now have the tools to go and find that. So you're going to see an absolute outpouring of these kinds of discoveries over the course of the next 2 or 3 years, because finally we have the powerful tools to do this. And that's going to be very exciting, because when you have the opportunity to find the genetic contributions to a disease, that then gets you in a position to be able to apply this clinically. And some of those applications will be to identify who's at high risk by using this information diagnostically and then offering them prevention. We're already starting to do that, for instance, in some families that have a high incidence of cancer. We can figure out who else is at high risk even before they've developed any symptoms and make sure those people are getting very frequent screening to be able to pick up cancer while it's still easily treated. There are many other opportunities where diagnostics and prevention of that sort are going to become a reality over the course of the next few years. We're also learning that these variations in DNA are a powerful way of predicting drug response. That's the field of pharmacogenomics. Do not be surprised if in the next 4 or 5 years, when you are in need of a drug for some condition, that the physician wants to check your DNA first before writing the prescription to be sure that that's the right drug for you in the right dose. Because the variation in response to drugs, which is well known, much of that is based on differences in genetics and can be predicted as we generate more and more of this data. But perhaps most excitingly, all of these discoveries about genetic contributions to disease finally put us in a position of being able to have really detailed information about why disease comes about in the first place. And so instead of designing empirical treatments, we have the chance to design those that really go right to the heart of the matter. And some of those will be gene therapies, but I think many of them will be drug therapies that are based on that kind of precise understanding and are therefore more effective and less toxic than many of the drugs we currently use. And you can already see the leading edge of this kind of gene-based drug design happening, particularly in cancer, with drugs like Gleevec and Iressa and Tarceva and Herceptin, all of which have come along fairly recently and which are specifically targeted towards a knowledge of the genetic glitch in a particular condition. In those cases, it is lung cancer or leukemia. So this is good news. I notice I didn't label the axis over there because I don't know, and it'll be different for each disease. And some diseases will move from top to bottom here in the course of a few years, and others will take longer than that. But I do think it's fair to say that by perhaps 2020 anyway, medicine will be quite dramatically changed as a result of this. And even by 2015, for many diseases, you'll see substantial differences. And perhaps as soon as 2010, the opportunity for doing some of the diagnostics and prevention will become a reality. And that's certainly something very much to look forward to. Another thing that we've learned a lot about is looking at our own genome, which parts of it seem to be most important for function. And this is now going to get us into a comparison of genomes, which, of course, will then lead us into a discussion about evolution. If we look at our own DNA, those 3 billion letters, and we line that up with the DNA of other species, you can begin to ask, okay, what seems to be most similar? It's not surprising that the parts of the genome that code for protein tend to be the most similar ones when you look at other organisms, but they don't count for all of it. In fact, they only count for about a third of the most functionally important part, that is, mostly most conserved sequences in the genome. The other two-thirds falls in places we didn't really know were important before. And this is an incredibly important tool now for zeroing in on the parts of the genome that we most need to understand that are probably most vulnerable if they have mistakes in them in terms of causing disease. So an incredibly powerful and forward-looking part of genome research right now is based on this kind of comparison between species. And although it took us 13 years to sequence the human genome, we can now sequence a mammalian genome in about 6 months, and that's getting shorter all the time, because the technology has roared ahead so quickly. And that is providing us with incredible opportunities to do these kinds of comparisons. So we have the mouse genome sequence, which was derived not long after the human, the dog genome. This is kind of a cute cover if you look closely here. Dogs admiring this. And if you even look at the picture of Watson and Crick, there seems to be another a character that's been interposed. That's Tasha, the boxer, who was the blood donor for the sequence that was used to get the dog genome sequence. So Tasha is admiring the results here. So we have that. And perhaps of greatest controversy to many people, we have the sequence of the chimpanzee, our closest relative. And yes, when you do line up the DNA sequence of humans, in the areas where they line up, which is almost all of it, the identity is 98.8% between us and our closest relative. So we're all 99.9% the same, but the chimp is only 98.8% the same. So enough differences there, apparently, to cause a rather different appearance and a very different organism, and one which we as believers would say is profoundly different. But at the DNA level, it's pretty subtle. And you might ask, if you've been looking at the paper lately, what about this? We are engaged now in sequencing the genome of the Neanderthal. There are enough specimens of bone available from various burial grounds in Eastern Europe to be able, with very careful technologies, to extract DNA from these 30 to 40,000-year-old specimens. It's hugely complicated because any contamination from any other source and suddenly you're sequencing human DNA and not Neanderthal. And even when you do get the Neanderthal DNA, it's been chemically degraded, so there's certain bases you can't trust and you have to sort of guess what those might have been. But it does look to me as if in the course of the next 2 or 3 years we'll have a pretty good representation of what that genome looked like. And so far, it's about what you would have guessed based on what people had predicted in terms of how long ago it was that Neanderthals branched off of the same tree that ultimately gave rise to Homo sapiens. It does not appear at the present time, although this is early days, that there actually was interbreeding between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens in Europe, although it's pretty clear that they were both there at about the same time. So we now have DNA sequence on all of these organisms that you see appearing here, and many more are in the pipeline. So over the course of just a few years since the sequence of the human genome, we have information on more than 30 genomes at a very reasonable cost. This is actually a very tiny fraction of what is being spent on biomedical research. But this is incredibly valuable information for trying to understand our own genome. That's really the point. I mean, those organisms are all kind of weird and wonderful, but the point for me is to use that information so that we can try to see what can we learn about our own sequence. And let me show you how that's done. This is the kind of analysis that a comparative genomics expert would do. And this is a rather small stretch of the genome, about 30,000 base pairs. So that's 0.001% of the total. And you're looking at a segment of DNA on chromosome 7. And across the top here is a diagram of what we knew before we started this in terms of what genes were there. And this happens to be a part of the gene which, when it's misspelled, causes cystic fibrosis. So CFTR is the name of the gene. This box right here is an exon, so that's a part that codes for protein. All the rest of what you see here is what we call intron. It's big spacer segments of DNA in between the protein coding regions, and CFTR has a lot of exons and introns, and some of the introns are pretty big. Now, what you're looking at in the green boxes here is what happens if you take that same homologous region from another organism that contains also their version of CFTR, and you line it up with a human, and then you ask the computer to tell you how similar are they. And so the taller the green bar, the more similar they are, and you can see the chimpanzee, as I told you, is extremely similar all the way across, and that would be true no matter where you look in the genome. And gorillas and orangutans and baboons and macaques and vervets and marmosets are also very similar, but you are getting a little further away. You can see the similarities beginning to drop. When you get down to about, say, the armadillo and a variety of other mammals here, then things get a bit spottier, and there's certainly regions where the computer can't really find a matchup at all, you know, sort of blank areas here. But you can keep on going down to possums and wallabies and platypuses and even birds and fish, Tetraodon and Fugu being fish. Then everything pretty much drops out. You'll notice, though, that there's one thing that stays there, and the computer finds the exon just beautifully when you have this kind of comparison. So that's the one thing that you can find when you go all the way down to fish, and that matches precisely with the protein coding part of this gene. But what about the rest? Is this just noise? I think your eye would have a pretty hard time picking out from the rest of that and saying, is there something here that's statistically significant? But the computer can do this quite nicely and will tell you, oh, no, this is not noise. There are clearly areas here that have been subjected to some kind of constraint. And here is one of them. And interestingly, knowing that, we went back and studied this gene a little more carefully and discovered, what do you know? There is an alternative exon in CFTR. For all the years we've studied this gene, nobody had noticed that. But when you have the sequence in front of you by this comparison, you know to go look for it. It is. And I'm not sure what it does, but it's probably important because it seems to have been in some way conserve down through a long period of time. And then you can find some other places, like over here, the computer says there's something really interesting. By the way, this blue track is sort of the computer summary, which can be calculated with all the sequence in front of you. So we studied that one a bit more, and it turns out when you look at evidence of a functional sequence, one that regulates gene expression, tells this gene when to turn on or off, there's a very important one right there, a signature. And we didn't know that, really, before having this information, and the computer sequence helped us see that. And then there are these others that are still waiting to be figured out that are highly significant statistically but are still in search of a function. And this is a typical region. And as I said, about a third of what this analysis tells you turns out to be the exons that code for protein, and the other two-thirds is like, wow, I didn't know about that. And that has opened up a whole area of really fascinating research for people to work on. Obviously, this has really significant consequences in terms of what we think about evolution, and I'll come back to that. You can build, by the way, an evolutionary tree solely based on the sequences, and that's what it looks like from all those organisms, not just from the cystic fibrosis region, but lots of other regions as well. And this is what the computer tells you is the most likely, the most parsimonious tree of relatedness of all these organisms. And interestingly, that's exactly the tree that people who have studied anatomy and people who have studied the fossil record have come up with. There are no real discrepancies here. So, this does bring us to evolution, which is where I want to dwell for a little bit. Obviously, this has been an area of enormous contentiousness and caused, I think, considerable distress on the part of believers since Darwin's Origin of Species, published in 1859. And it almost seems to me as if the distress is getting worse, despite all the decades that have passed since that theory was originally put forward. If I was the one who was designing the way the experiments would come out, I'm not sure I would tell them to come out the way they have, but the data is the data. And so I want to share with you what the data points to as far as the evidence for the relatedness of species from a common ancestor. And that evidence, I will tell you, really points, really without any ability to deny it, to the fact that we humans are also part of that. And I know that is not a conclusion that many believers are comfortable with. But I think, again, if we are searching for God's truth, we need to see what God's truth tells us. First of all, the fossil record certainly is consistent with Darwin's theory. I'm not an expert on the fossil record. I would point out, though, that for those that have pointed to this as an incomplete demonstration of evolution, that many of the gaps that have frequently been referred to in certain publications are rapidly being filled. We have filled more gaps in the fossil record in the last 10 years than in any of the times before that, and including something like this, which is a very interesting find just reported a few months ago of an organism which had its fossil dug out of an outcropping almost in the Arctic Circle. Which clearly shows an interesting anatomy, that is, of something that looks a bit like a fish but has already developed the ability to be able to move around on land. And if that was one of the things that people said we'd not seen an example of, here it is. But what I'm more knowledgeable about is the study of DNA. So, obviously, when we see those similarities of DNA between different organisms, there are two possible conclusions. If you believe in multiple acts of special creation, that God created all of these organisms as individual events, but used the same successful motifs over and over again, then you could end up with DNA sequences that look similar between organisms and could include ourselves. So similarity alone doesn't address the question of common ancestry versus special creation, or as some would say, gradual creation versus special creation. But when you look at the details, it becomes difficult, I think, to continue to sustain those two options as equally likely. And there are some examples. There are many, but I'll just cite a short list. One that we now know a lot about because it was part of sequencing is human chromosome 2. When you look at the chromosomes, which you can see under the microscope of a human, there are 46 of them. They come in pairs. Chromosome 2, you have two of those. When you compare our chromosomes with that of a chimpanzee or a gorilla, they look a lot alike. In fact, they look stunningly alike, with one exception, and that is chimps and gorillas seem to have an extra pair. And when you look at human chromosome 2, It doesn't seem to have something that looks like that in chimp and gorilla. Instead, chimp and gorilla have two other chromosomes that are smaller. So how does that work? Well, now we have the sequences. It's pretty clear to see how these things are all related. Turns out, human chromosome 2, which is shown schematically here with the banding pattern that you can see under the microscope, has this anatomy. And here are those two extra chromosomes that the chimpanzee has. And in fact, just by looking at the banding patterns, people were able to say some time ago that what was extremely likely to have happened is that sometime in a previous ancestor, these two chromosomes had joined head to head in order to generate a single chromosome that looked like that. Well, now we have much more detailed evidence than just looking at it under the microscope, because we have the sequence and we can look. And these colored balls basically tell you what kinds of sequences you find in these chimp chromosomes and in the merged place in the human. And I say merged because when you look at the sequence, that's inescapable. There are sequences present in this part of the chimp that you would not normally find in the middle of a chromosome, and you don't find in the middle of any other chromosome, but you find them in chromosome 2. And they are not functional sequences. They are repetitive sequences that mark things like centromeres and telomeres. And so this gives you a signature, a footprint, if you will, at the DNA level of what apparently was a chromosome fusion. All of the other primates have the chimp version. Human have the exception. And so the conclusion from looking at that is almost inescapably that we are descended from a common primate ancestor, but that fusion occurred somewhere on the branch that gave rise to Homo sapiens. Another example, pseudogenes. So pseudogenes are genes which look pretty good. The computer for a little while might say, that one might be working. But then when you look really closely, you can see the pseudogene has suffered some kind of a fatal flaw. And they come in various flavors. But some of them are looking pretty good, except maybe they have what you call a frame shift or a nonsense mutation, something that absolutely knocks out function. Now, when you look around the genome, you can find lots of places where the same genes occur in the same order in multiple species. In fact, that's usually the rule. If you look for gene A, B, and C in the human, and then you go and look in the chimp, and you find A and C, you'll almost always find B in between. And even if you go to the dog or the mouse, you're very likely to find that as well. Another argument, I think, for common ancestry, although one could also argue that there's some reason why they have to be in these orders. But occasionally, and now we have the genome sequences, we can look and see how often this happens. And it's not a huge number of times, but it's a number. You have a situation like this, same order of genes in dog and chimp and human, but you look very carefully at that middle gene, and it's a pseudogene. It has recently, if you just look at molecular clock arguments, encountered an inactivating mutation that has rendered it no longer functional. And some of these genes are probably important, actually, for human functioning. You know, the idea that humans developed new characteristics by gains of function may not always be true. Sometimes you need to jettison a few things in order to be able to acquire some new characteristic. And there are good examples of that that people have pointed to. For instance, the jaw muscles. There's a gene, a myo-16, which is an important protein for jaw muscles. In fact, many primates have very powerful jaws, and that protein is very important. We humans have a pseudogene for that particular protein. We don't make that one. And when you look anatomically, you can see that our jaw muscles are much less powerful, and some have even proposed that that might have given a chance for the skull to grow larger and accommodate a larger brain. That's a bit fanciful, but it's been proposed. Now, how do you explain this kind of finding on the basis of multiple acts of special creation? Very difficult to do that. Unless you're going to postulate that God wanted to test our faith, and so he put a pseudogene right there in the place where evolution would have predicted it to mislead us. That's not a comfortable conclusion for me. When I think of God's omnipotence and his creative genius, the idea that he would also be a bit of a trickster, it doesn't feel right. And there are so many other examples like this that it really doesn't feel right. A third example. If you look across our genome and just ask, are there things here that happen a lot? I mean, sequences that are repeated over and over again? Well, yeah. About 50% of our DNA is made up of these repetitive elements. Some of them probably have function, but I would doubt very much that all of them have important functions. And there's a class of those that you can tell are actually quite diverged from each other, which implies that they're quite old. And when you look at that class at different species, you can even see that same class of elements popping up in the same place in other mammals. So if this is a human set of genes, again, this A, B, and C in that order, you might go and look at the mouse. Again, you'd be likely to find A, B, and C in the same order. In this particular circumstance, if you go looking for those repetitive elements, you'd be likely to find some of those in the same places. Not all, because things have been perhaps coming and going a bit. If you looked at one of them, like this one in my little diagram here, you would find this ancient repetitive element, which is repeated many times in the genome, has about the same similarity between human and mouse as the sequence on either side, sequence in this case not of a gene, but of some space or DNA. So how did that get there, and why is it in the same place? And particularly, if you look hard enough, you can find some of these where that repetitive element actually didn't land properly. These are transposed, and sometimes when they're transposed, there's a break that occurs right as it's trying to insert itself, and you end up with a decapitated repetitive element, which has only part of its sequence, and which is completely devoid of function. And what do you know? When you go and look at some of those, you find that this very same decapitated element with the breakpoint in the same place occurs in that homologous segment of human and mouse. Again, it's hard for me to imagine what's going on here if it's not an indication of a common ancestor, in this case, a common ancestor of mammals. So, that's the data. Now, again, I think as believers, we should look carefully at that. We should rest upon the rock of the faith that we have been given. And we should consider what the options are for the ways in which this can be all integrated. Some of our colleagues have chosen this option, as you all know. And they are beating us up because they perceive that we're running away from the facts, some of which I have just shown you. And I don't think that is necessarily going to be a good strategy, particularly if what we're trying to do is to not only defend the faith, but also to draw other people to it. But atheism is out there, and it's getting more shrill by the minute. Richard Dawkins, the primary proponent in my field of this, has a book coming out in October called The God Delusion. You can tell where that's going to go. And, of course, he is, throughout the course of his incredibly articulate writing career, have been making this case against faith, going well outside the evidence that he could derive from science to make comments in areas that science really does not have much to offer, namely about the truth or falsity of faith. He says, faith is blind trust in the absence of evidence, even the teeth of evidence. So Dawkins is very successful in painting a caricature of faith. Does that sound like your faith? Doesn't sound like mine. He paints it that way, and then he dismantles it. And a lot of our scientific colleagues are carried right along without realizing what's happened there, that the faith that he has described is not one that we would all embrace anyway. So I would say, as an argument against that perspective, we're on very firm footing, on pure logical grounds. If God exists, God is not entirely enclosed within nature. Science is the way that we investigate nature, and that's all that science can do. And therefore, science is completely unable, on purely logical grounds, to exclude the possibility of God. And one who makes that stance has just committed a major logical error. I find that carries a fair amount of weight. And maybe because I used to be an atheist myself and it carried weight with me, I see that as a particularly powerful argument to bring to the table when you're having that kind of a discussion with somebody who's heard a little too much Richard Dawkins and bought into it. So I actually think we're on very strong footing here to be able to defend against that claim. Evolution does not demand atheism. It absolutely doesn't even belong in the same sentence. Of course, many of our colleagues are more likely, instead of being strong atheists saying, I know there is no God, to say, well, I'm just not sure. I don't think there's any way to know. And of course, that can be a legitimate position if it has been put in the context of considering the evidence. But most of the agnostics I know are agnostics because they just don't want to deal with it. It's not that they've considered the evidence and found it wanting. It's that they have not really had the evidence put in front of them. And again, I think those who decide to take that path, again, I'm speaking from personal experience, often surprise themselves by being converted. And That's what we should try to encourage people to do. And I think we should point out to an agnostic that you would not admire somebody who said the age of the universe is unknowable if they'd never considered the evidence. So why would you admire somebody who says the existence of God is unknowable if they'd never considered the evidence? Other positions obviously have been taken about how to reconcile evolution and Christianity. And one is simply to say evolution has to be wrong. And that is the creationist perspective. And I have great love and compassion and empathy for many believers who are in this camp, who have been led by their own reading or by the teachings of others to believe that this is the only way one can be a faithful follower of Jesus Christ, is you have to defend the absolute literal truth of Genesis 1, or you've somehow started down a slippery slope that's going to lead you inexorably to denying the resurrection. I don't agree with that at all. And I found great comfort, in fact, in reading the interpretations of some of the most wise theologians who came along long before Darwin and therefore really had no reason why they had to apologize about evolution. And my favorite of those is St. Augustine. And I wish this statement were read more regularly in many religious circles. And he's writing here, and Augustine was absolutely fixated, it seemed, on Genesis. He wrote 5 books about the interpretation of Genesis. And he struggled and he came up with various interpretations, and I won't go through what they were. But I think the most important thing he said repeatedly in those books was, whatever your interpretation is, don't hang your hat on it too strongly, because no one can really figure this out from first principles. And he says, in matters that are so obscure and far beyond our vision, we find in Holy Scripture passages which can be interpreted in very different ways without prejudice to the faith we have received. In such cases, we should not rush in headlong and so firmly take our stand on one side that if further progress in the search for truth justly undermines this position, we too fall with it. And I think the creationist perspective runs that very serious risk. To put it somewhat harshly, I don't think you can be a young earth creationist without basically denying the basic principles of cosmology, physics, geology, chemistry, biology, paleontology. It's not tinkering around the edges that will get you there. And I think one of the great tragedies of our time is that that circumstance has not been addressed and admitted to. And so we are still asking young people to accept the idea of a literal reading of Genesis 1. And then when they find out all of the facts of those sciences, they shake their heads and wonder, how can I accept a science that's telling me things that seem so counter to what my belief system told me? And for that matter, how can I accept a faith that tells me things that science seems to completely contradict? This is not a way to draw people to faith. And in fact, I think more and more young people simply turn away. Some of them turn away from faith, some away to turn away from science, some from both. And that's a terrible tragedy of our present time and a completely avoidable one. Another comment from St. Augustine. What kind of days these were, it is extremely difficult or perhaps impossible for us to conceive, talking about the days of creation. And of course, 2 Peter with the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. How do we paint ourselves into this corner? And yet we have. The Gallup poll from just 2 years ago asked these questions. You could quibble about whether the questions were asked in a precise way, but I think it's pretty clear what they were trying to find out. Of the 3 options being provided here, 38% said human beings developed over millions of years. God guided the process. 13%, God had no part. But the largest percentage, 45%, God created human beings in their present form within the last 10,000 years. So in this country, despite what we as scientists have been discovering, we have been very unsuccessful in conveying that to our friends and church-going neighbors. What about intelligent design? Now, here I know I'm getting a little closer to the edge with an audience like this, where probably there are quite a few of you here, perhaps a lot of you, who are quite attracted to this particular possibility. Intelligent design is a very interesting arrival on the scene. It's certainly raised a lot of interesting discussions about this concept of irreducible complexity. How is it that you could have something like the bacterial flagellum with its many different protein components, where if you take one of them away, it stops functioning. So how could it be that evolution could actually generate something as complicated like that when you'd have to have 30 different proteins co-evolving and you'd gain no benefit until they'd all assembled together? That's the basic argument of irreducible complexity. And this is what very thoughtful writings of Johnson and Behe and Dembski and others have been about. And I think this has provided a real opportunity to think about these molecular machines and what might be their possible explanation. But I fear that this is another proposal that is showing cracks already. Because if you look at the more recent data, now that we have lots and lots of genomes, so we can make lots and lots of predictions about these various protein complexes, including the bacterial flagellum, it does not appear that these emerged all of a sudden. In fact, what appears to be the case is that even a multi-protein wonder like the flagellum was constructed by recruiting bit by bit proteins that had other functions. Presumably the genes for those proteins got duplicated, so the old function was maintained, but the new copy had a chance to take on a new function. And given sufficient time, which evolution offers you, I think the vast majority of biologists who've looked closely at this do not see any reason why one has to invoke a supernatural influence in order to achieve the complexity that we see in the clotting system or the eye or the bacterial flagellum. So my fear, although I've been very interested in this discussion, is that this is a God of the gaps theory, which is perhaps in record time because science is moving forward so quickly, going to be shown as such. And so if we as believers have attached our faith and tried to present our faith to others on the basis of this approach, and it turns out to collapse, what have we then done? We've made God too small. We've put a God in a position of having to fix the evolutionary process that he didn't quite design right to begin with. And if that's turned out not to be the case, then what has happened here? I think we have not really put science at any risk, although many scientists are running around complaining that intelligent design is a threat to them. I don't really think that's nearly as much of a concern from my perspective is how it could be a threat to faith, because I fear it's going to be wrong. The fifth option, and the last, and of course, you can therefore guess, it's the one I'm going to put forward as the one that I think makes perfect sense out of all this. And this is the option often referred to as theistic evolution, which is simply that God designed this process. He used it in a way to create creatures, including ourselves, with whom he could have fellowship. And I like this comparison of images. We humans have been searching for God and trying to depict him. Maybe all along he's been trying to show us his incredible creativity. This is DNA looking down the long axis. And I have no problem putting together what I know as a scientist with what I know about my faith in this particular context. So if God, who is not limited in space or time, chose to create human beings in his own image using the mechanism of evolution, who are we to say we wouldn't have done it that way? Unless you insist upon a literal reading of Genesis 1 and 2, this seems to me an entirely compatible description of what has happened. Now, some people are worried, well, evolution seems so random. Well, to us, because we're trapped in this linear axis of time. But if God is outside of space and time, in the very moment of that flash that we call the Big Bang, he could also have the whole process worked out, including our having this conversation tonight, and it would not be random at all to him. For me, this provides an enormous sense of comfort, a harmony that I can't find in other ways, a way that draws me in the direction of worshiping an almighty God who has more creative power and majesty than I had ever imagined would be the case before these kinds of observations came along. I don't expect that this necessarily grabs onto everybody, but it does seem to me that this is a credible, intellectually defensible, and enormously comforting synthesis. Theistic evolution is unfortunately a terrible label, isn't it? I mean, who would want to be a theistic evolutionist? I mean, it really sounds awful. Most people aren't quite sure what a theist is. And when you say theistic evolution, the noun is evolution. That's what really matters, right? And theistic is this sort of throwaway adjective like, well, okay, maybe that part isn't nearly as important. I think we got a problem here with our description of this. At least I feel, from my perspective, if this is the harmony we're seeking, couldn't we give it a more attractive label. So I modestly propose here a label that I think says the same thing, and it hasn't already been contaminated by being used in some other way. So many of our words are already like off the table, because you can't say creation and you can't say intelligent and probably can't say design, and maybe we should call this crevolution. No, I don't think so. So instead, what are we talking about here? We're talking about life, bios, but life that comes into being because of God, because of the Word, logos. So this is bios through logos, or maybe simply biologos, God speaking us into being. Now, this sounds a little metaphysical, but I like the way this sort of comes together then, because then we've got DNA, this wonderful language, and here's where the language of God comes about. God, in his amazing mind, coming up with the plan for life, including each of us, creatures that would have the moral law, in whom he would infuse an eternal soul at the time of the Garden of Eden, in whom he would give the ability to seek him, in whom he would give free will that we would choose to disobey him and making us fallen creatures. But speaking all of that into us, through this amazing process of evolution using the molecule of DNA, the language of God. We're all walking around with 3 billion letters of it. So let me conclude, because I've run a little later than I was supposed to, and I still want to have questions, but I gather we've got a little breathing room here, just with an exhortation, because I think this is an appropriate group to think about this. This is a critical time, it seems to me, for Christians and for our whole society. If we take the tack of trying to fight against conclusions from science that are pretty unmistakable, we run the risk of appearing to be sort of out of step with the modern time, and to appear to be intellectually not completely honest. We can't allow ourselves, it seems to me, to say, well, God put the data in there to fool us. That just doesn't seem like a tenable position when you're trying to promote the idea of a loving God. So I think instead we should follow this exhortation from a little more than 100 years ago from Benjamin Warfield, who's really a remarkable theologian who, very much seeing the world rocked a bit by Darwin at that point, wrote these words. And I think this ought to be a good motto for all the members of ASA. We must not then, as Christians, assume an attitude of antagonism toward the truths of reason or the truths of philosophy or the truths of science or the truths of history or the truths of criticism. As children of the light, isn't that what we are? We must be careful to keep ourselves open to every ray of light. Let us then cultivate an attitude of courage as over against the investigations of the day. None should be more zealous in them than we. None should be more quick to discern truth in every field, more hospitable to receive it, more loyal to follow it, whithersoever it leads. I think that's a wonderful way for us to face up to all of the observations and discoveries that God has given us the ability to make, and to realize that as we make them, we are in greater, not less, awe of God Almighty, and that he has given us a chance to discover the majesty of his creation, and in that process, to worship him. And that is the theme of this book that I tried to put together over the last year, in which I hope will now at least start some discussions amongst those who have been basically sold a message that science and faith are locked in combat, and that there will be no prisoners taken, and that ultimately one or the other is going to win. That seems to me is a terribly sad and unnecessary prospect. The stage has been dominated too long by the extreme voices coming from atheist scientists on one end and fundamentalists on the other, who demand that science has to conform itself to narrow readings of particular scriptures. And I think if we as scientists could get together and speak perhaps a bit more openly than we have on this topic, we could help a lot, because there's a lot of us. And I think in many ways, we're the best hope that this battle has of being put to an end. We started this battle. We humans did. Only humans can end it. It's not God's battle. It's ours. But if we are loving of each other and serious followers of him, I think we can do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate this delightful lecture, and we appreciate the time commitment you've made to join us and enlighten us. And we're very grateful for your insights on this. Do you believe that evolution is the greatest impediment to bringing scientists to Christianity? Or do you think it is indeed the agnosticism that you talked about, where they just don't take the time to sort it out as you did in your own testimony?
I think it's all of the above, and I think it's different for each scientist who's not become a believer, and that's why we have to get to know our colleagues a little better in this regard and not be afraid to engage in those conversations. I think a lot of scientists' resistance is sort of because of the profession that we all carry out, which is to focus on the rigorous demonstration of facts using data, and the idea of changing that mindset to think outside of scientific questions into spiritual questions makes many scientists just downright uncomfortable, and they don't want to go there. But there is also, I think, this genuine issue of just being too busy, feeling slightly like, oh, I'm not sure I really want to think about that. I'll put it off until someday when I really need to make a decision. And there again, I think we can be helpful to those people to help them realize that they're really missing out. It's not as if there's something to be afraid of. There's something to be afraid you're missing. So I every person's a little different. Yes, Jim.
Well, again, thank you. Your words, as always, were lucid and insightful. Greatly appreciated. Evolution is elegant. Let's use that description.
Yes.
But it's not always beautiful. It embodies a great deal of struggle and pain. What does it say about God's priorities and character to choose a method of creation that requires so much suffering?
So that's a great question, and I know it does trouble a lot of people to contemplate this whole business of natural selection. Why would God do it that way instead of, you know, bringing some happy, healthy creatures immediately into being? And I don't have an easy answer to that. I don't have an easy answer to many of these questions. I do think when we look around us, we can certainly recognize the fact that in our own lives, it is not necessarily God's intention for us to have a completely happy, unstormy experience. And suffering seems to be part of our life. We don't seem to live in a garden of delight. We live in a vale of tears. And why is that? You can ask it on an evolutionary scale, or you can ask it in each of our own lives and of those we see around us. And I think the bottom line, although it's not necessarily an easy one, and theologians who have thought a lot more about this, and especially I think of Lewis and his book called The Problem of Pain, would say that God's purposes are not necessarily for us to go along smoothly without some sort of challenge and even suffering. And I think that's been true ever since life got started. For us in particular, God's purposes are to try to help us find him. And we rarely seem to do a lot of that when things are going well. But when we hit a rough spot, as Lewis says, God shouts in our troubles, even though he whispers when things are going well. He shouts, it's his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And if that's true of us today, then why would it be surprising that the evolutionary process would carry with that as well? We may desire to think of a kind of creation where there was never any suffering by anyone. It doesn't happen to be the world that we see around us or that has been there all along.
This is a question from our audience. Which bothers you more, non-Christian scientists who attack you or sneer at you for your faith, or Christians who attack you for not holding to their understanding of Scripture?
So I've been getting a lot of email over the last 3 weeks since that Time Magazine piece and Good Morning America and Charlie Rose and all these other places where I talk pretty openly about my faith. And certainly I've been bothered by some of the messages from both sides. I have to say for myself, the ones that wound me the most are from fellow believers, who some of whom really have unloaded a pretty strong set of opinions, including considering me a false prophet. That was a little hard to take. And, you know, that in a certain way is the image that a lot of non-believers have of Christians, that we're narrow, we're critical, we're unloving. And that is a heartbreaking circumstance. And when you see it coming at you, you know what they're talking about. So you know, it's fine. I expected not everybody would be enthusiastic when you sort of stake out a harmonious position. There are some people who are not really interested in harmony, and they're going to let you know, and that's fine. If we've in some way got a chance here to have more conversations of this sort, that is the main goal, and the rest of it is just fine. Shall we go back and forth? Is that the plan?
I think that's the plan.
Okay.
Many good questions here. Won't be able to ask them all, but how about this one? Was there a particular person named Adam who played an important role in human history? For example, Paul writes in Romans 5:19, "For just as through the disobedience of one person, Adam, many became sinners, so also through the obedience of one person, Jesus Christ, many will be made righteous."
I don't know the answer to that. If you read the little short paragraph that I wrote about Adam and Eve in the book, you will be pretty clear that I'm not sure how to make the most of that particular part of Genesis 2. It seems to me, from scientific grounds, that there are strong reasons to say that there were more than two founders for Homo sapiens. When we look at population genetics and track back how many founders would it take to explain the variation that we see across the genome, not just the mitochondria, not just the Y chromosome, but the whole thing. The estimates are in the neighborhood of 10,000. And it would be very difficult, therefore, to, on the basis of science alone, to advocate for Adam and Eve as the parents of all of the human race. But I very much take Adam and Eve as the moment of infusion of the soul, of the moral law, of free will, and of the fall. And I think those are critically important to our understanding of God's character and our own. Now, were they historical figures, two of those 10,000 that were the first to make that transition from animal to human, and that ultimately that found its way into the rest of the species, even though the rest of the species was also going along? Or were they intended to be representative of us in a more allegorical way? I don't know. I think you can defend both of those perspectives on a scientific ground, and I know people have very strong feelings about how to defend them on theological grounds. I look, again, as you can probably tell, C.S. Lewis is my own spiritual mentor in terms of the writings that he's made. Read his part in The Problem of Pain, where he describes his own view of creation. And it's pretty clear that he couldn't either figure out whether this was intended to be a literal couple or not. And he also felt that we had wasted way too much time worrying about that specific interpretation when we should have been talking about other things like God's love. Yes?
You mentioned the potential for good with gene therapy and identification of gene defects. But there is some fear that this will lead to selective abortion, such as is now sometimes done for Down syndrome. Could you comment on whether these types of fears are valid?
Yeah, I think this is an area of considerable concern for believers and others who are really troubled about the prenatal applications of genetics. I am one of those. It seems to me that if the consequences of all our discoveries about genetics are to be primarily in that arena, we will have failed and failed severely. My hope is, and I think it's beginning to be borne out, that in fact the real payoff of genetics is going to be our ability to treat, to prevent disease in people who have already been born by figuring out what to do to keep them from falling ill. But I don't know that we can necessarily stop the applications of these discoveries in the prenatal arena. And I think we have a very serious issue here, particularly when it comes to this a new technology called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis that allows you to make selection of embryos before deciding which ones to implant, that people are inclined to go further and further in the direction of milder and milder conditions in that circumstance, perhaps even ultimately towards traits. And I think that is a major area of unresolved bioethical discussion that we need to have, and a place where I think believers should be at the table and having serious conversations about what society is really prepared to do and not do. Yes?
How do you deal with people who suggest that sinful behaviors, moral behaviors, and belief in God or morality are all basically just genetically coded?
And they do, don't they? That's a great question. So, you know, there's this whole field of sociobiology, which argues exactly that, and there are many advocates of that. E.O. Wilson, a particularly prominent proponent of this, also a prominent atheist. Daniel Dennett wrote this recent book called Breaking the Spell that very much goes along this line. And all of this argues that, in fact, evolution can account for everything from the moral law, altruism, and even the search for God, which is a universal component of human beings. When you look at those arguments, I think they're actually quite hollow. They come across as a list of just-so stories. And in many instances, I think you can actually argue quite compellingly that what they're saying is counter to what evolution would do. And I think particularly this applies when you talk about our instinct to try to do something for somebody else who is in trouble. Evolution operates not really on the group, it operates on the individual. If I'm walking down the bank of a river and I hear somebody in the middle of the river calling for help, and I look out there and it's my worst enemy, evolution would say, let him go. But somewhere within me, and you know what I'm talking about, is this urge to say, I should try to help that person. It would be wrong not to do what I can, even though I may put my own life at risk. I cannot explain that on the basis of sociobiology. I don't want to hang my faith on this argument, but I think it's a pretty interesting counterargument to some of the psychobabble that's being put out there by some of the folks who are in this particular field, who start with the premise, you know, that there has to be an evolutionary explanation for everything. So here's one, and never really consider the alternative.
You receive much criticism for your faith in scientific circles, and have you discussed your faith with Francis Crick?
I have actually not experienced much criticism, and I think that's encouraging, and I would encourage all of you who are worried about that, if you talk about your faith, that people will sort of come at you. I think there's some sort of polite changing of the subject that goes on from people who are pretty uncomfortable just talking about it. But as far as actually coming at you and saying, you shouldn't be talking about that, that's not appropriate for a scientist, you're offending me, that almost never happens. In terms of Crick, I've only met Crick a couple times. He's obviously now gone. He died about a year ago. A very sort of austere, somewhat unapproachable fellow. And we did not talk about faith. He pretty much decided the conversation, and it was about sort of the history of DNA, because we were in a more public setting. But I've had many conversations with his partner, Jim Watson, who is an outspoken atheist. And I wouldn't say I've made much headway with Jim. And I'm sure he would say he hasn't made much headway with me. I sent him my book, and I'm still waiting for a response. How are we doing, bud?
How about we do two more?
Okay. Okay, and then I have a little concluding thing, which won't take long. Yes.
Could you comment on the risks involved in knowing the predispositions to disease? Who may have access to this information, life insurance companies, etc.?
Another great question. So there are risks, and they're risks which have been identified now quite clearly by lots of scholars and experts from the perspective of ethics, law, and theology. If we are all born with glitches in our DNA sequence, this should not be used against us to take away our access to health care or a job. That's almost a civil rights issue, and it's certainly a matter of justice. You didn't get to pick your DNA, and it shouldn't be used against you. And yet at the present time in this country, that can happen. A number of states have taken action, but there's still no federal legislation to prevent this, despite more than 10 years of effort. Oh, did I do that? That's what's coming next. So the efforts of many of us... Suddenly, the computer has developed. It's trying to hurry me along. I think that's a message here. There is a bill that has passed the United States Senate 98-0, which was a very gratifying day. I sat in the gallery and enjoyed that experience. And I figured, well, that'll do it, because it's a very good bill. It covers both health insurance and the workplace. And the president announced that day that he would support the bill. If it came to him, he would sign it. That bill was passed February of 2005. This is now late July 2006, and the House has yet to take action on that bill, despite the fact that there are now 227 co-sponsors as of right now. But the way things work, the leadership has to decide to take this up. It's not been assigned to any hearings, and the number of legislative days, as I'm sure Congressman Ehlers would agree, is getting pretty short. And I fear we're headed for, yet again, a really severe disappointment when the public has made it very clear in multiple surveys that they need and hope for this protection. But a small number of special interests have managed to keep it out of legislative action in the House. Last question.
How are we to relate to those Christians who see the tough issues like young earth creationism or ID as a powerful and true evangelistic method? Or do we simply not want to confuse them? How do we relate to them?
That's a really tough question, because I think we have to, in all cases, be loving. And what we must not do is to sort of go after somebody who's putting forward that perspective in a way that doesn't accept their sincere belief and their love for Jesus. At the same time, I do think that we can't necessarily just turn and walk away. If we all share the same faith and we can see in these instances that this is something which is really out of the truth that God has given us the chance to discover, I think that requires a gentle, loving conversation. And if you can get somebody engaged enough to look at the facts, then perhaps that can do some good. I should say there's a wonderful book out there for people who are of that persuasion, who are, I think, looking to try to find out what does biology say and willing to read about it. Daryl Falk wrote a book called Coming to Peace with Science. It's published by InterVarsity. Daryl is an evangelical, is a biology professor at Point Loma Nazarene, writes beautifully and goes through many of these arguments in a very gentle, loving way, but a way that I think could really reach people who are open to the possibilities of reading about that.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I know you all are tired, and I know ice cream is waiting, but I just thought, since we've been here a little bit, and I know from this morning that this is a group that likes to sing, that we ought to close out the evening with a little song. One moment. You are really good sports to be positive at this point. Okay, now, I might need help advancing the verses when we get to them. Oh, did we? Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Is it on there? Okay. Oh, all right. Yes. Now, can we go forward one? And can you just sit there and advance the verses as we get to them? Okay. So this is, the bottom is going to be a little hard to see. But, you know, when you get to that part. So this is written by Thomas Troeger, who's an incredibly talented hymn writer and now at Yale. And he takes hymns with familiar tunes and writes verses to them that I think are just spectacular. And this one about faith and learning could certainly be a good hymn for the ASA. And it goes to the tune of Hifradol, which I think most of you know. So maybe you could stand up. We've been sitting a while here. It's just three verses. I'll change keys on the last verse, so go with me on that, all right? Oh, we've got a little obstruction here in the middle. Praise the source of faith and learning that has sparked and stoked the mind with a passion for discerning how the world has been designed. Let the sense of wonder flowing from the wonders we survey keep our faith forever growing, and our need to lies a day.
not stand where your purpose for creation and the pulse of life is found. As to currents in a river fight each other's undertow, till converging they deliver one coherent steady flow. Blend, O God, our faith and learning till they carve a single course, till they join as one returning praise and thanks to you, their source.
Amen. Thank you.